Well, hello again to everyone. My name is Paul Weber, and on behalf of my colleague and the co-founder of Teleclass Education, Dr. Syed Zatar, let me welcome you to the Teleclass Extreme Makeover, Exploring New Challenges to Our Identity in Infection Control. It is indeed a real privilege today to welcome Gwyneth Myers as our Teleclass faculty. As is my custom before every teleclass, I did a little research on Gwyneth, so to sound at least modestly intelligent when I introduced her. Gwyneth is an infection control professional at Alberta Children's Hospital in Calgary, Alberta, and a research analyst for the University of Calgary. She is the president of the Southern Alberta chapter of CHICA Canada. She's published in the American Journal of Infection Control, the Canadian Journal of Infection Control, the Journal of Infection and Immunity, the Journal of Continuing Education in the Health Professions, and probably a few other journals that I didn't find. However, all of that aside, I know Gwyneth to be a remarkably capable and creative and intelligent and compassionate person who is extremely well-respected in the infection control community, and she puts together some pretty snazzy PowerPoint slides, too. So to present the teleclass, Extreme Makeover, Exploring New Challenges to Our Identity in Infection Control, from Calgary, Alberta, I am absolutely delighted to present the incomparable Gwyneth Myers. Gwyneth.
Thank you, Paul, for that introduction. You've got me chuckling over here. I'm humbled. Good morning and good afternoon to everyone online. Thank you for this opportunity, but before I go any further in this talk, I really would like to acknowledge Dr. Manuel Ma, who is an infectious disease doctor in the Calgary Health Region here, and he's really the first author of on this paper that this talk is based. And really the purpose of this talk, I hope, is to present a series of ideas that really evoke thought and discussion amongst our profession. And I would sort of just summarize it as a compilation of my own musings and an integration of Dr. Ma's intellectual and philosophical conceptualizations. Certainly he has a talent for that. And as well as an integration of the lived experiences of my colleagues in our infection control department here. So starting with this first slide, I would just sort of pose the thought that I'm one of those people that need 8 to 9 hours of sleep. I can't live on 5 or 6, as I know some people can. But that leaves me with 16 hours a day, of which at least half of it is spent in my work environment. And I have to admit that some of it also moves over into my dream life on occasion. I don't know whether that's a good or bad thing. But what it boils down to is I want my work to count. It's important to me. It's important to who I am. And it plays a significant role in my identity. Therefore, I suppose it's not surprising that I've spent time thinking about what does the nature of my work mean to me and what is its impact on my life. So I looked up the word identity in the Oxford Dictionary, and it says it's the fact of being who or what a person is, and it's the characteristics determining this. And I've also been quietly listening to my colleagues as they plan their retirement, of which there are several people in our profession doing this now. And what I find them when they're talking about it and they're planning their succession is they talk about the meaning of their work life. And they also talk about how much of it has been a part of their identity and who they are and what is that going to mean to them when they move forward in their lives. So I also know that what they spend time, if they want to transition out of infection control, that really they want their work to have meaning. So if we can move to the second slide, I put this photograph of the burning hut up there because that's my screensaver on my computer. And for me, that is my reminder of what is meaningful to me in life. Some of you know that my passion is for African dance, and I have been involved in Africa. But this photo actually was taken in Uganda in the northern part in a refugee camp in Gulu. And while my friend was there, the fire broke out and just spread through the refugee camp. And these are people who had nothing to start with and even had less after the fire went through. But I was actually looking for a segue into this talk, and I was actually looking for a picture of a fire because if you look at this quote, and I would encourage you for entertainment reading value to go to the Bible and read chapter 13, Leviticus, because in the time of Moses, they were certainly doing infection control in pre-modern times. As evidenced by this quote, he shall look on the plague on the seventh day. If the plague be spread in the garment, the plague is a fetting leprosy. It is unclean. He shall therefore burn that garment, for it is a fetting leprosy. It shall be burnt in the fire. So they were practicing actually isolation, disinfection through fire, and control. So if we go to the next slide, from miasmas to MRSA, I wanted to talk a little bit about our history of infection control and my own personal experience of coming to infection control. When I started, I've been in infection control about 10 years now, and my move originated when I worked in an infectious disease lab doing research, and I actually developed severe allergies to the animal models that we were using. And I knew I had to make a career change, and also I found that the lab wasn't quite my personality fit. And as I decided to go do my master's in community health and epidemiology and healthcare, I got harassed royally as being a traitor and abandoning the real science and those hard sciences for that soft, wishy-washy stuff. So I kind of identify with this thought that when I first came into infection control and I'd watch and try and figure out what is infection control in this new field I'm in, and I kind of got this sense when listening to people that we suffered from what I call younger sibling syndrome. As infection control is a fairly new profession, and trying to take its stand besides more traditional professions such as microbiology and medicine. So I actually went onto the computer and looked at the website for APIC and CHICA, and looked at the beginnings of infection control, which are in 1970s. And in the APIC website, it starts off where it said that infection control was started in recognition of the need for an organized, systematic approach to the, quote, control of infections as required as a result of hospitalization. But I thought it was interesting to look at our mission statements in these two professions, to organizations, because I really think they speak to our IPC identity. They describe who we are and what we're about. So I want you to think as I go through these definitions, just keep some of the words that are used in them in the back of your mind as we talk through some of this stuff in this talk. So the APIC mission statement says, to improve health and patient safety by reducing infection and reducing the risks of infection and other adverse outcomes. APIC advances its mission through education, research, collaboration, public policy, practice guidance, and credentialing. The CHICA Canada mission statement is, it's committed to improving health of Canadians by promoting excellence in the practice of infection prevention and control by employing evidence-based practice and application of epidemiological principles. This is accomplished through education, communication, standards, research, and consumer awareness. So if we go to the next slide, who are we today? What is our identity? Certainly there are a lot of variables that are challenging us in our profession. We have emerging diseases. We've gone from HIV to BSE to SARS to West Nile virus. And we have the problem of antibiotic resistance and the looming increasing impact of MRSA particularly. We have the evolution of the patient safety culture, which I think we would all say that we have, that has been part of our business. But the patient safety movement has grown up beside us as well, and that influences our profession. We are practicing in increasingly more complex organizational structures, and we are involved with changing technologies I can remember when I first started working on a computer when I was doing my master's and trying to do DOS commands that would take forever. And the first time, I'm trying to learn what's a hard disk versus a floppy disk and all those things. Right now, too, we're doing real-time bedside e-records and all that kind of thing. And in preparing for this talk, I thought, well, I'm just going to fire out an email to my colleagues and ask them, so in all your years of practicing infection control, what do you see as the changes? And what was interesting is as the responses came in, I could break them down and summarize them into these categories that I just mentioned. And what some of them said was they really noticed a shift from disease model to patient safety. And that's an important thing that I want to talk about in a minute, because really we're going from the concept of control to prevention. And then people also said, we've got an increased profile. We are now more involved. We have a more expanded role. And because of the increased technology, we've required to have more knowledge, but it's caused an increase in our workload, and it's added to the complexity. And the whole concept of complexity was outlined in comments related to we have more complex patients, more complex care. We have mixed generations. We have the traditionals that probably experienced the depression. Our grandparents have young children, young grandchildren or grandchildren that could be working alongside them as the millennials. They're the youngest group. So there's the traditionalists, there's the boomers, the Gen Xers, and the millennials. And they all come with different approaches to work and different values, and that is important in terms of how we look at our mentoring, how we look at how we do business. The millennials are wired. They're in. They look at us boomers or the traditionalists as like, you guys don't know anything. You don't know all this computing stuff. So there's that huge complex generational issue. We're dealing with a rate of change. We have to respond more quickly. We don't have as much time to plan. And as I indicated, we have changing diseases. And we certainly are integrating with other professionals. So we are collaborating. So that means there's a lot more players in our lives. So if we go to the next slide, what I think is happening too is in addition to these variables that are impacting and influence our profession, this shift in IPNC is occurring within a greater shift in the mainstream contemporary culture. And this greater shift is as profound as the shift from the Middle Ages to the Renaissance. So it is a shift from modern to postmodernism. And so in my mind, I know that it would make sense to me if we are experiencing some kind of turmoil, questioning our roles, questioning it's just not the same as it used to be, what's happening, where are we going, it's not surprising then if we're questioning the meaning of our work life and our role. And it's very, in the midst of this change, it's very hard to define and describe what's really going on because it's in transition. So I'm going to subject you to one of my passions and quirks. I'm a Trekkie. I know that maybe makes me a geek, but I love Star Trek. And I'm taking a bit of information from a paper that was called Star Trek and the Postmodern Generation by Stanley Grenitz, Grenz in 2004. And I'm going to talk a little bit about modernism and postmodernism, and use some examples of writing of Star Trek, the original Star Trek, and the newer Star Trek Next Generation. So if we go to the next slide, modernity. What is modernism? Really, the short thing is it's a scientific era. It's the age of enlightenment. So postmodernism really is a trend of thought that affirms the power of human beings to create, to improve, or reshape their environment for the benefit of mankind. And this is really characterized by a focus on optimism and reason and human freedom. And this is done through the use of scientific knowledge, and that this scientific knowledge is actually deemed to be very certain, objective, and good. And hence there's this reliance on technology and practical experimentation, and leads us to ultimately be very optimistic, in essence the belief that progress is inevitable in every day and every way we're getting better and better. So if you go to the Star Trek, this is exemplified in their writing. When you look at who the crew is, they're a group of human beings who are working together to overcome differences for the benefit of mankind. And they're using science and technology to, quote, boldly go where no man has gone before, to conquer the universe, which is the final frontier. And their leader, Captain Kirk, is very much a character that is one in control, and he's going to kind of fight for the right and the outcome and overcome these obstacles. One of the interesting characters, and the only, quote, non-human, is Spock. And Spock is part human, part Vulcan. But it's his non-humanness that's interesting because it transcends the human ideal. He's kind of the enlightened man who's very rational and non-emotional, and it's that rational non-emotion that's very key in problem-solving. So the Star Trek in the 60s really epitomizes sort of the modern approach. When you then switch to, let's go to the next slide, which is postmodernity, what is it? It actually, it's interesting because a lot of the beginnings of postmodernity is attributed to the German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche in the 19th century. But I don't think we in our contemporary culture started seeing evidence of the postmodernism until the mid-70s or into the 70s. And what postmodernism is really a largely a reaction to modernist assumptions that there's this certainty in scientific or objective thinking to explain reality. In fact, postmodernism is sort of called the age of deconstruction, so it's actually quite skeptical of the explanations and claims that's valid for groups, traditions, or cultures, or races. So ultimately, there's no overriding meta-narrative, no overriding one truth or story that would explain something. In actual fact, there's a focus on relative truths. Every person has a truth, and their interpretation is everything. So there's no one meaning for the world, only different viewpoints and perspectives. And this leads to a large pluralism and potentially a very great deal of fragmentation because of this no one meta-narrative or truth that can be explained and provide common meaning for people. The interesting thing, too, about postmodernism, though, is that they look at other ways of knowing. There are other ways to gain knowledge through historical learning, through relations, through personal experience, and that truth is very relative to the community we are in. And so reality itself is very relative and intermediate and participatory. So this is highlighted in the writings of the next Star Trek that came out, The Next Generation. And in that Next Generation, you can look at the crew and they have a new ecology. They are more diverse. There's other races. Humans are no longer the advanced intelligence. They're in partnership with the universe. And one of the characters, Data, that replaces Spock, Data is the perfect intellect. He's the perfect science. But he's not perfect because he's always trying to understand what it is to be human. He feels that incomplete because he lacks emotion. He lacks the ability to dream. And so there's this shift from Spock to Data. Also, Counselor Troy, another character, epitomizes the idea of other ways of knowing. She's a betazoid. She has the ability to read how other people are feeling and uses that knowledge to solve problems. And in the Next Generation, they're more likely to explore the concepts of God and religious beliefs that would probably not have been looked at in terms of the first Star Trek series. So what has this got to do with infection control? If we go to the next slide, IPC Modern Identity, and I have to say that this is where I feel comfortable with my science background, my generation. It is certainly the comfortable identity that I will slip into. So from an IPNC point of view, science has been our main method of knowledge. And if you just take a look at the language we use, we talk about things being evidence-based, best practice, standard practice. And it makes sense because if we came from a disease model, we are using science to deal with and manage this disease model approach. The thing about this is, though, is the disease model is very linear. The dynamics are much more simple. We're dealing with concepts of cause and effect. So you know, you get exposed, you have transmission, there are consequences. And we've based our traditional jobs and our approach to infection control on dealing with the disease model. So we have our surveillance, we have our epidemiology, we develop our policies and guidelines and standards, we provide our education based on this, and we do research and QA around all of this. And it's not to say that these things aren't important, but are they sufficient? If we are in a culture of postmodernism, is this sufficient to do our job? And if it isn't, what does this mean? So let's go to the next slide, which looks at the IPC postmodern identity. And this is where I think we've moved from the disease model more to the patient safety model. And it's resulting in us having to focus more on the prevention rather than the control side of things. And we are more and more being asked to deal with aspects of behavior and behavior change. So we're moving beyond data into a very much more complex, non-linear field. And we don't have necessarily the language in our collective IPC culture to deal with this because we're evolving toward this. And you don't, to look at our training, most of us aren't psychologists. Most of us don't come from education backgrounds. We come from nursing, from microbiology, from medicine fields. And so, you know, where are we? Are we having to learn behavioral theories, learning theories to do our job? And we have to do our job, but we're learning on the fly, and we're learning in addition to our traditional roles. And we're being asked to do this in this complex environment that is full of information and communication, requiring speed and efficiency, and maybe sometimes at the cost of human relationships. We are in a culture that's adverse to risk. And we have an audience that is far more informed because of information and technology and more autonomous. And because of the postmodern identity or the postmodern modalities, they're more likely to challenge our authority, and they're more likely to be more assertive for their own individual rights and values. So in some ways, I think this switch into postmodernism challenges and creates ethical dilemmas for us in infection control, because I think it creates an uncertainty of action sometimes. Who are we? Where are we? How do we do this? How do we do our job? What is our identity? So we're challenged in our own field for ethical reasoning and decision making, and we're taxed in our leadership and our credibility when we are challenged for our authority. So how do we maneuver ourselves when we're in an environment with social fragmentation and intellectual ambiguity? So I'm going to go to the next slide and want to kind of switch a little bit of topics and say that if we have an ethical dilemma in trying to deal with our identity and uncertainty and change, I would say, though, that we're not alone in this shift. And that's the good thing, because we will be joined by others. Other people, everyone else is moving forward in this mainstream cultural change from modernism to postmodernism. And we're well situated, I think, in infection control because we naturally tend to collaborate. We've learned that the policing mode really isn't the most effective way to do infection control. And so we are good at collaborating. So we will be joined by others. And one thing that I found very interesting was that the bioethics field also emerged at the same time infection control was emerging. And I want to talk a little bit about some ethical concepts here, some emerging ethical concepts or frameworks that may be very helpful to us and guide us as we maneuver through these changes. The first ethical, political, philosophical concept that is gaining interest is what's called communitarianism. And really what that is, it's a way of thinking that honors the ability of people to seek mutual satisfactory solutions to common ethical problems, which really means that we're emphasizing the well-being and values of groups of people or communities that's best determined and shared by a kind of a democratic decision-making process of stakeholders. So it's one framework that I'm going to refer to a little bit as we go on in this talk. What's also happening in the ethical field is there's another ethical approach called virtue ethics or character ethics, a framework that I also think is important and valuable for us to look at as we do infection control. And virtue ethics really incorporates the idea that it's not just duty and results that matters, the rules and the outcomes, but also includes the fact that character and emotion of individuals also matters. So it's not just what we do, but who we are in our work. So in virtue ethics, they classify seven virtues. Four of them come from Plato, and they're called the four cardinal virtues, and that is practical wisdom, justice, temperance, and courage. And then there's three transcendent virtues that are actually biblical-based, faith, hope, and love. So what we're saying is that, in short, the moral principles governing or influencing how we conduct our work are based in these virtue ethics, so that when we have a postmodern emphasis on the individual, it makes sense that who we are becomes important in our infection control work. We need practical wisdom in our decision-making. We need justice to seek a balance between the individual rights and the common good of the group. So that comes into play when we deal with concepts of isolation and outbreaks. We need temperance. We need to use restraint on how we use our resources, and that comes into play when we're challenged with being efficient and productive, or when we're trying to feel like there's too much bread out there and we're just like a little piece of butter that can't get spread all over the place. Courage. In a busy, demanding healthcare culture, we need the courage to dialogue with health professionals, to challenge thinking, to stand up. And we need faith, hope, and love, which are not necessary, but are what are supererogatory. That is, they're above and beyond the call of duty. But I see it in a lot of my colleagues, in their passion, compassion, and care in what they do in their job. And that partly is what makes them good and trustworthy and builds relationships. So while we have our certain modern approaches and our traditional identity and infection control, we don't want to throw that away because it has power to solve types of problems. We've learned that. We need to incorporate new ways of being in our business to embrace the new postmodern modalities. So if we go on then to the next slide, what I want to take in the next part of this talk is to look at more practical approaches that we have tried in our department and try and outline them for you as ways that we've been trying to maneuver and deal with this change in our identity. And that is basically taking a socio-ethical approach, and I'm going to go through each of these four areas: individualism to community, rationality to rhetoric, productivity to practice, and monologue to dialogue. And really what it is trying to find other ways of doing our business. So if we go to the next slide, from individualism to community. Really, what this is we don't need to stay in our little, the safety of infection control, but can seek out beyond ourselves, cultivating a community of practice with others to gain and glean the benefit of their language, their knowledge, and their approaches. So what is a community of practice? Basically, it's a group of people who share a concern or a passion for something they do and learn how to do it better as they interact regularly. That's a quote from Etienne Wenger. So let's go to the next slide, a comparison of models. Because in infection control, we naturally work with other people. We collaborate well. What distinguishes a community of practice from other groups or activities that we work in? Well, if you look at the second line, a formal work group, an example of that might be like I sit on a flu planning committee. And our purpose of that committee is to plan for influenza every year, plan how to do it better, identify gaps, improve service delivery of a vaccine or whatever. And the people that sit on that committee are based on the role they need to play. So are they communication? Are they OH&S? Are they IPNC? You know, what role do they have on that committee? And that group reports to another body. And it's held together because it's a job requirement and they have common goals. And it will be disbanded ultimately if there's some reorganization and it's deemed that they no longer will report to their reporting structure and there's a different way of doing this work. So that's a formal group work. A project team is very specific, put together to do a task. So if we were working on the interactive hand hygiene module, a group of us got together to work to develop the module. Either we're assigned to it by our managers or we have different skills and expertise, knowledge of hand hygiene, knowledge of education, IT abilities, and we work on the project, we achieve the goals, and it ultimately lasts until the goal is completed. Then informal networks are really more kind of just to pass on information, and they can be loose friends, acquaintances, and it's held together by mutual needs, and it lasts as long as the need's there to communicate. So community of practice really goes above and beyond those three groups. And in our department, we started by developing a learning innovation team, and it resulted because we were frustrated in how we provided education. But we all had a passion for education, and we wanted to find ways to be more effective at providing education. And so we came together, and some of us went and looked at how to do focus groups and learned how to do focus groups and brought it back to the group and shared that information, how to do in-depth interviews, how to collect information. Some people went off and started exploring storytelling as a means of social influence. Some others went and looked at drama. Then we looked at developing social marketing skills. We ultimately moved into becoming a social marketing group that was sort of more like a formal work group. And that community of practice dissolved into a formal work group. But we've developed a new community of practice where we've got IPNCs and educators meeting twice a week over coffee and sharing our stories and experiences and solutions. So if we go to the next slide, in a community of practice, really what we're doing as IPCs and educators, we have three main variables that define the community of practice. One is the domain, and that's really our common ground. We're coming together because we're frustrated again with education. We are all trying to do education. They, as educators, are trying to educate from an IPNC point of view. They're challenged with the same ways we are, as how do you get people's attention. So we're coming together. We identify with our domain of knowledge and the joint undertaking and our situation. So we see this as a joint enterprise bringing us together. What's important about a community of practice is the relationship building, because in a community of practice, it's very important to have relationship and trust in joint activities as you move forward together, because there's a lot of risk-taking. You want to start looking at trying to be very innovative, and that means you've got to trust people in terms of sharing your ideas, you know, not to be bashed down for something really off the wall, but maybe it's a really creative idea. So the third piece, so that's the important part of community. And then the third piece is practice, that you're sharing knowledge at the same time as you're going out and doing a variety of activities, and you come back and you're solving problems and you're scanning out there for other ways to solve the problems. You bring feedback for your practice. You have a review of it, and then you go out and you try it again. So that's really a community of practice. Let's go on to the next slide. So the first piece is, as infection control practitioners, we are not alone, that we can glean the knowledge from other people in this postmodern world. So the next piece, rationality to rhetoric. Now, I think we've been talking about clearly in the whole idea of modern identity that we use rationality. Rationality is evidence-based, scientific truth and logic, and we use it to make policies and decision making. And historically, that's our identity. So what do you do when you have strong evidence base for medical innovation, but you don't have speedy adoption of it? And I think we can all relate to that in terms of vaccination. We know vaccination works. We can talk till we're blue in the face about the value of vaccination, how it works scientifically, blah, 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 blah. And then you get wham, you know, with the most illogical responses back to you. What do you do in behavior when you're trying to change behavior? How do you deal with that rationality? How do we persuade people to change their behavior when they reject the evidence we present them, or they question our authority or the credibility of those that are presenting it? So let's go to the next slide, examining the evidence, because I think it's a value to explore and look at the evidence that we're trained to use. Traditionally, we are trained to use science, but what do we do as practitioners when the evidence is clear? We get on the phone and we start calling around. We say, hey, what do you guys do? Hey, what do you? We start looking for common practices. We start looking for hands-on experience. What are other people doing? So what really that says is actually evidence is very complex. And in fact, there are different types of evidence. There's scientific evidence based on observations which are predictable and logical and testable. But there's anecdotal evidence, hearsay. There's testimonial evidence, and you see that often in advertising, and say some sports person, and I use these Nike runners and they're great or whatever. We have personal experiential evidence. You know, how many times have we gone on to a unit and someone says, I know it's C. diff, it's the smell. It's that sensory evidence, touch, smell, taste, that personal experience. And we have intuitive knowledge, gaining direct knowledge without evident, direct, rational thought that's more related to inference. So we've got this complex set of evidence, but along with it comes a series of issues that we need to consider. So, for example, there's no one body of one piece of evidence that is there. Evidence is susceptible to competing interpretations. And all we have to do is take a look at the whole debate on pandemic and masks to know what that's all about. Also, there is the availability of quality evidence. I don't know how many people say, but I want a really good case control study on hand hygiene to prove to me that it really works. That comes from doctors. I don't know if you experienced that, but I've gone through that. So then there's the hierarchy of evidence. And what that means is evidence may vary across disciplines and the type of evidence they value within a profession. Certainly professional networks will influence behavior based on what they perceive as the evidence that they value in their profession. And the problem is that evidence does not readily flow necessarily across professional boundaries. And, I mean, all you have to take a look at is the difference between when we're trying to communicate infection control issues to physicians and some of the challenges we experience there. So the question is, how do we communicate across boundaries? If we go to the next slide, I'm going to talk a little bit about the art of persuasion. And that really is looking at the whole idea of Aristotle, and he talks about there are three parts to persuasive speech: logos, ethos, and pathos. Now, we're, I think, all comfortable with logos because, again, of our evidence-based identity and training, our modernist approach. And I, as I talked about, what do you do when you present your logical argument and you're countered with personal rationale or personal argument? You know, well, I've never gotten sick. I come from good genetic stock. Some dirt is good. That's a very postmodern approach to argument. And so we need more than logos. We need more than evidence and logic. When we're persuasive, we also need to have the our impression, who we are as people, as speakers, becomes important. Do we sound sensible? We have knowledge of the subject. We sound insightful, perceptive. Our character, are we respected in, and it kind of goes back to those virtues. What is our character? Are we honest? Are we trustworthy? And benevolence, is there a genuine concern for the welfare of others? So when people are saying they've got XYZ problem, do we listen to them? Are we real? Are we down to earth? Are we compassionate? That's how we, our presentation of who we are gives us credibility as speakers. And then the third piece is pathos, which is really appealing to the emotions, values, and imagination of an audience, which really says that behavior isn't followed that it's logical, that a lot of behavior does not necessarily result from isolated facts, but rather from volition and emotion. So we need emotional intelligence and social competence when we're presenting, not just be knowledgeable. So if we take the variety of evidence in its various forms and use it to transmit knowledge, in the context of persuasive speech, it's important to use these things as we try to change behavior. And the whole concept of virtue ethics might not seem so unreasonable. In fact, that as IPCs to become leaders of change, we have to acquire skills of perceiving, of understanding, of managing ourselves and others' emotions. So we need ourselves to be emotionally intelligent and socially competent. So that's sort of the rationality piece. So let's go to the next slide on rhetoric. I don't know if I told people to move to the last slide on persuasion, but we're now on the slide of rhetoric. So let's move from the idea of evidence and rationality to rhetoric. What is rhetoric? It's really the art of study of using language effectively and persuasively. Every aspect of human life and thought that depends on the articulation and communication of meaning can be said to involve elements of the rhetorical. So really, when we have pathos or emotions and postmodernism, pluralism, that whole many meanings, there's a link between the need to persuade and capture people's imagination and shift into the importance of the personal perspective, their experience, their reality. And one of the ways that one can do this is through storytelling and drama. It suggests that they would be useful tools for education and behavior. So that's what we started doing. Let's move on to the next slide. We dream in narrative. In our department, we have been exploring the use of storytelling and drama as tools to educate and capture people's imagination and engage them in an otherwise very busy and competitive environment. And what's important about these is that, first of all, learning is very context-driven, and people will learn when they see the usefulness of the knowledge they're given. So if you're using drama and stories, it needs to reflect something that's realistic and credible for them. They need to be able to relate to it. But the beauty is that when you do this kind of approach, it's very collaborative because you're doing it together. You have an audience, and you have the players. And so there's a participation, and it goes back to that whole concept of communitarianism. You are valuing them and working with them. It's also a very intuitive approach because it integrates us at an emotional level and an intellectual level. We have to learn at two levels. We are learning emotionally by being emotionally challenged. We have to reconcile differences, and we have to think it through. And this is actually very innately hardwired in us because we all tell stories. Every day we tell stories. At lunch we sit down and say, guess what happened to me? We go home, I talk to my husband, tell me what happened to you today? And we tell each other stories all day long. We start telling stories when we're kids. It's very natural to us. It's engaging because it involves imagination. If you have a play or a story, it affects everyone. It's memorable because you immediately put yourself in that story. You immediately start thinking about your own stories, and you create, you have your story, you are hearing a story, and you create a third story when you go tell someone else. So it's a very important way to create knowledge and get people to tap into their lived experiences, their tacit knowledge that is above and beyond the practical, that basic knowledge, that scientific data type knowledge that we think of. So it allows for reflection and thought. And so we just came off of a third approach. Well, we used clowns, and we're still trying to identify whether or not that was very effective, but it was certainly, I felt a little bit like I'd stuck my neck out there and explored something different. And I don't know quite how effective it was, but we encourage people to just try and explore all these different aspects, whether it be poetry, whether it be stories, whether it be to go and read the fields and explore that. So let's move on to the third approach that we've been trying to explore in our department, and that's the whole concept of productivity to praxis. So what do we mean by this? Systems versus outcomes is really relating to productivity. This is a lot of restructuring has gone on in the healthcare, dealing and looking for efficiency, for profitability, and quality. And this really creates ethical challenges for IPNC and healthcare workers. And all we have to do is look at the main literature on hand hygiene to talk about issue of time and busyness are barriers to hand hygiene. Or what happens when we cost cut to our housekeeping and maintenance departments. Or getting people to use personal protective equipment when they're really busy. If we embrace the values of efficiency, productivity, competition, and profitability, what are these implications for trying to change behavior, for prevention? What if they're in conflict with the concept of patient safety? Or what if patient safety challenges IPNC epidemiological and surveillance approaches where we have zero tolerance and mandatory reporting that might create political and ethical challenges to us? How do we do this? How do we go about doing these? What if productivity challenges us and there is using these mandatory reporting and zero tolerance for competitive advantages between hospitals or for funding or whatever? These are points to consider if we're looking at productivity, because we're looking really at the idea of duty and outcome and results. And this is important, particularly in a postmodern environment, where postmodern mind values individuality and autonomy, and that we need to consider then, are the behaviors of healthcare workers autonomous? And if they are, how is that determined by processes of care and productivity and those pressures? And if there is an autonomous healthcare worker, are they directly responsible for patient care outcomes? And if there's a poor patient care outcome, is that related to the individual or is that related to a system that is ineffective, that's focusing broadly on results and outcomes and not the individual? And thirdly, if healthcare workers are autonomous, what motivates them to perform to excellence? Where is their sense of relationship, responsibility, and ownership? Where does this lie? So again, if we go back to the language of ethics, we have to look at our duty as well as our character as individual persons. So that brings us back to our personal virtue ethics of who are we. So let us move to the next slide and talk about praxis. Aristotle actually broke disciplines down according to their purpose. So he said that there are disciplines that are theoretical, and those disciplines are basically concerned with the pursuit of knowledge for its own sake. And then there's productive disciplines that are designed to be efficient, effective, employing technical and creative skills to produce a product reliably. And then there's practical disciplines, which is praxis. And that's really healthcare. And what that is are disciplines that rely on wisdom to advance the welfare of others. So really, it takes into account the situational context and what is truthful and right to do within that situation. It's not just an action, but it's based on moral reflection of the context, which is what caregiving really is all about. So it's a fusion of both knowing and doing. Now, the problem is we have to look at patient outcomes. If our goal is to advance the welfare of the patients, what happens with regard to outcomes? It may be that we provide really good care, but regardless of the good care we provide, there is a poor outcome. The flip side is we could have medical errors in the process of care, and we end up with a good outcome regardless. So outcomes are unpredictable, and we know that there's no such thing as risk. In a postmodern era, we need to look at where does the responsibility of the individual lie? And there's a value in placing it on the individual, because in the context of the idea that healthcare is a practical profession, that we have praxis, a courageous, reflective healthcare worker can avert a disaster and promote a positive outcome based on their lived experience, their practical wisdom, because they've applied it to a situation and prevented a problem. But if a system overrides that because of productivity and takes away individual autonomy for the benefit of productivity, then we can fail the patient because you don't have the ability to catch those problems. So from an IP&C point of view, what does that mean? What it means is we really need to have a system that if focuses on behavior change and supports behavior change, and that's where the virtue, the ethics of communitarianism comes in, where we value others, where as IP&Cs, as individuals, we have the ability to, through practical wisdom, apply it to situations and value and focus on individual healthcare workers and their values and their importance and their personal behavior. And it's for us to remind them of the value that they have, and yet we need to balance that value of the individual, that postmodern value of the individual and individual rights, with the value of others. So that whole idea of justice, the virtue of justice, that an IP&C needs to say, well, it's good for you to do vaccination for the benefit of others, as well as the benefit of yourself. Wearing PPE protects you as well as it protects society. That if we speak to them, that it may be of value for them to sacrifice some personal freedom for the benefit of others, but at the same time, they're protecting themselves. So finally, let's go to the fourth piece. So we don't do this alone. We can maybe use other ways of knowing and capture the imagination through storytelling and focus on the individual. So let's go to monologue, from monologue to dialogue. Really, this is really about how we communicate and the language that we use. And we know that language helps to change culture. And if we look at what is culture, is the beliefs and values and behaviors of a group of people, whether it be nurses, doctors, whether it be a unit, whether it be a building, a healthcare facility, whatever. It's the culture within that group that's based on values and beliefs and their behaviors. So what is the culture that promotes behavior change? Well, part of that, if language influences culture, then what is the language we're using? How are we communicating? What are the conversations we're having? So what is monologue? I'm monologuing to you right now. Nobody's talking back to me. I'm just jabbering on here, pontificating on my whatever. But monologue is essentially a speech made by one person speaking his or her thoughts aloud directly to a reader, an audience, a character. And there's basically kind of three mindsets, monologue mindsets. And these actually deny, when you're monologuing, you deny conversation. And one of them is objectivism. So what that means is it's my point of view. Differences don't exist. There's really only one truth, and I'm telling you the truth. This is the truth. And often when we fall into our evidence-based approach, we're saying, here's the knowledge, this is the evidence, this is the truth, you should take this and change. That essentially is a monologue. Subjectivism is a second type of monologue, and what it means is there is no reality, that shared meaning is impossible because everybody has their own viewpoint. And the trouble with that is you can't base a decision, you can't base anything on one viewpoint, and that creates fragmentation. So where do you go? That's confusing. It doesn't allow, though, for dialoguing. Subjective objectivism is a combination, kind of, where it says there are differences, but they don't matter because my opinion is the one that counts. And that immediately cuts down the ability to have dialogue. So what are our mindsets as infection control practitioners when we are engaging others in conversation? we need to be committed to dialogue so that we can allow other people to express their views and interpretations and understand their values and differences so that we can look at changing their behavior by understanding their culture. So if we go to the next slide, dialogue, what that really means is that we need to increase our understanding of multiple perspectives and create a wide variety of possibilities. And that really is a quote from a Russian philosopher. And basically he's saying that dialogue emphasizes the power to increase understanding of multiple perspectives and create possibilities. I've just been living with a fellow from Africa, from Malawi, for the last 8 weeks, who has been going around speaking to people, fundraising, and he would say to people at the end of his talk, thank you for listening. And he says, in my culture, even if you don't take action, even if you don't do anything, the fact that you have sat here and listened will change you. Because in his culture, to listen is very, very important. He says, listening creates peace. Listening causes you to change just by the fact that you listened. So from an IPNC, how do we foster this? How do we gather different views and interpretations of other people, other departments, even though they may not jibe with what we know, even though they may seem really different, they're not scientifically valid or whatever? By getting to understand and know who they are, we can ultimately potentially change behavior because we, if we hear them and get their support, we can get them to buy in. People tend to buy in only support what they create. So if they create something based on their values and their chain, their beliefs, even though it might not quite fit ours, we actually may ultimately have some mutual interest that we can go forward with. And that takes me then to my next slide, which is related to social marketing. So in infection control, in our department, we have really been involved in social marketing as a way to promote change. And that's basically because what it's dealing with is asking us, again, to be more communitarianism in our approach because we want to deal with mutual interests. So if we look at this table, basically, we traditionally have focused in on the right-hand column, which is education. And what it does is we provide information. The thing is, the promise of that is not immediate. It's, if you do this down the road, a change will occur. It's a promise, but it doesn't necessarily lead to change. It invokes the right of the individual, which is compatible with postmodernism, but it doesn't foster collaboration. The middle column, sticks and promises, is a much more non-voluntary, very negative. It goes against the idea of the postmodern era of individual responsibility. It doesn't value that. And it's problematic. Both of the education and law policy sticks are problematic when authority is challenged. So marketing may be a useful way to go because what it does is it requires incentives. We're looking for the things that people say, this would be good for me. We're looking for things that would be immediate and positive based on their understanding of their culture, their needs, and getting them to engage with us through focus groups, through in-depth interviews, gathering information to say, what can we do? For example, if we want you to do hand hygiene, if we give you alcohol hand rub, it's quick, it's easy to do, you don't have to walk all the way down the hall. There's a mutual interest, it protects you, it meets us of protecting our need for you to protect others and not spread it all around. Your hands are better, it's quick and easy. That's the idea of mutual interest. So it supports the demographic ethics, the demographic democratic ethics of collaboration, where there's a balance of individual rights of the healthcare worker and the social rights of others, as well as engaging them to participate and be creative. So we've used social marketing as a method of trying to deal with this postmodern identity. And that brings me to the final slide, which is just to summarize this whole talk. I really believe it's important to think these things through, to find out who we are, where we've been, to help us define where we're going. And I really think it's important as we look at our generations, and we have large numbers of people retiring, and we've got new people coming in who are very much part of this postmodern mentality, who are very wired in, who are very tapped in. The millennials generation are, if you look at the different kinds of generations, they are very ethical in terms of they want their work to have meaning. But they're also very easily bored, so they're used to change. They're used to complexity, and they're more likely to move on. So if this is the people we're trying to attract into our profession, we need to be able to communicate with them. We need to be able to engage them. We need to be able to let them exercise their creativity in how we could do business in infection control. We could learn from them. So if we talk about mentoring, we can mentor them from with all our modern identity and all the epidemiology and all the knowledge we have gained, and they can mentor us in teaching us new ways of being in our infection control identity. Certainly we want to retain new people in our profession, and I think it will be very curious to see what infection control looks like in the next 10 years, in the next 20 years, in the next 30 years. Thank you very much.
Gwyneth, I thank you very much for a really interesting and thought-provoking presentation. In just the dying moments that we have left, there was at least one or two product labels shown during the course of this PowerPoint presentation, and I would just like to mention that Teleclass Education doesn't endorse or support any particular product or company, and where products are shown, it shouldn't be taken as an endorsement or advertisement. Thank you again to all of you for joining us today, and a special thanks, Gwyneth, for doing a stellar job with some really nice PowerPoint slides. I'm very pleased that you did this, and thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much.
And folks, until we meet again, goodbye.